Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's Podcasts. We are now ready for the final Chapter 15 from Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks. Wisdom Earned, Mount Fairweather. Here we go. My map was now complete, right? Oh, wait! Another peak had shown up. We had seen Mount Fairweather from the top of Logan in 1973, and I had seen and lusted after many photos of the beautiful peak. After Bona, my climbs of every major North American peak above 16,000 feet were over, and I had more than 12 movements in my Northern Mountain Symphony. What next? Would I climb every peak over 15,000 feet? 14,000 feet? 13,000 feet? Was there ever going to be an end to my quest? When I looked at the list of 15ers and 14ers, there were a lot of them, and many were difficult. It had taken me 44 years to do the 16ers, and I was now 60 years old. I did not have another 40 years. I had already climbed my token Alaskan 14er as an extra credit. That was Mount Hunter, a magnificent climb. I had also climbed my token Alaskan 13er as another extra credit. That was East Kahiltna Peak, another great experience. I decided that I was not going to climb all the 15ers, 14ers, and 13ers. What I needed now was my token 15er extra credit, and Fairweather was the obvious choice. Mount Fairweather, at 15,300 feet, is well southeast of all my other northern peaks and sits on the Alaska-Canada border at a pointy crook in the border near Alaska's southeast coast. Fairweather is only 14.8 miles from the open waters of the Gulf of Alaska west of the peak and only 14.5 miles from ocean water in Johns Hopkins Inlet southeast of the peak. Thus, Fairweather is almost surrounded by the Pacific Ocean and has the most misleading name of any great northern peak. It should be Foulweather. Captain James Cook named the peak in May 1778 on a clear day when he saw it from the ocean. Mount Fairweather is the highest peak in Glacier Bay National Park, the Glacier Bay Wilderness, the Huna-Angoon Borough, and the Yakutat Census Area. Also, Fairweather has 12,950 feet of prominence, which puts Fairweather on the list of Earth's 50 most prominent peaks. In fact, Fairweather is number 26 on that list. Another accolade that many climbers are unaware of is that Fairweather is the highest peak in British Columbia. For me, an ascent of Fairweather would complete the coveted High Five list of Alaskan County High Points. These high point honors attract many climbers hooked on high pointing, but for me, the big attraction was that Fairweather is singular, stoic, and beautiful. It is the point on the giant northern peak exclamation mark. Fairweather is dramatic when viewed from the Gulf of Alaska, and it is difficult to approach and climb from the ocean. Alan Carpe and Terrace Moore made the first ascent of Fairweather on June 8, 1931. They started at sea level, went up the Fairweather Glacier, and climbed the southeast ridge. In recent years, climbers fly from Haines, Alaska, land near 10,000 feet on the upper Grand Plateau Glacier, and climb the peak via its north-northeast cirque and upper west ridge. The modern route up the west ridge used to be an easy climb, but in recent years the approach up the cirque to the ridge has been beset by big crevasses. The final steep slope can have multiple gaping crevasses. Conditions vary from year to year, but in some years the route has proven impossible for mortals. Combine this with the usual foul weather and you have your welcome to Fairweather. 2005, right on cue, a trip to Fairweather that Chris Holland and Tim Haig planned emerged in 2005, but this time it was Holland's idea and he had a different agenda. Chris wanted to make the trip a ski expedition and ski down from the summit. Since I didn't ski at that level, that left me out of the equation. The only way I could clip into the trip was if I found companions who would snowshoe with me. I quickly recruited Job Wymore of Bona fame. Then Greg Griffith contacted Chris about the trip, and Chris sent Greg to me since he wanted to snowshoe. Greg was an opinionated loner who didn't like anything conventional. He wanted Fairweather simply because it was the high point of a national park. Chris also added some other friends to his ski team. So we departed as a team of seven, but we were really two teams with different modes of travel. When we arrived in Haines, the weather was perfect, and we flew right into the Grand Plateau with the pilot Drake Olson, who lived in Haines. Drake deposited us on the Grand Plateau as high as possible. Tim was feeling heroic and wanted to go for the summit from the landing camp, but we convinced him that we should move camp up to the entrance of the cirque at 11,000 feet. With continued good weather, summit day arrived quickly, and launching from our 11,000-foot camp, we were on our way. The climb to the saddle was steep, but there were no barrier crevasses. Once on the ridge, the skiers took a look at the West Ridge, abandoned their plan to ski from the summit, and sprinted for the summit on crampons. I followed with Job and Greg. While the skiers were racing up the ridge at high speed, Job, Greg, and I approached the bottom of the ridge. Job was leading, Greg was in the middle of our rope of three, and I was last on the rope. As we approached the little saddle at the beginning of the steeper slopes, Greg stopped abruptly, turned to me, and announced in a huge voice, "I'm not going another step." A sentence later, it was clear that Greg was abandoning his climbing career right here on the ridge. One moment I was heading toward a dream summit on a perfect day, and the next moment I had a problem. What to do? We stopped for a conference, and I made the biggest error in my northern climbing career. What I should have said to Greg was, "Fine, unrope, and Job and I will continue to the summit." Job was strong, and the two of us could have made it easily, albeit a little slower than the sprinters. Using Greg's own loner logic, if you abandon your companions on a high ridge, you are alone. What actually transpired was that my old team first logic swayed me. If Job had just said, "Jerry, let's go up," we would have had the summit. But he didn't lobby for the climb. After a pained, almost useless conference, all three of us turned and descended. The others summited, and I only had a bitter memory. I was obviously a latecomer to the modern me-first generation. 2007. 2 years later, my next trip to Fairweather arrived in Haines. This time I was with my longtime friend Rick Trujillo. Rick had climbed Denali, had worked in Alaska, and was no stranger to the Great Land. Dave Koval of Bona fame was there with his high-pointing friends John Mitchler, Edward Earle, and Dave Pellegrini. It was a strong team, and we were full of enthusiasm and optimism. However, this time the mountain played a different card. Drake, the pilot, greeted us under a solid gray sky. Usually willing to go for it, he looked at the weather and proclaimed that there was no chance of doing the long, difficult cross-glacier flight to Fairweather. We would have to wait, so with no choice, wait we did. We waited for days, then convinced Drake to fly up and have a look. We took off but quickly returned to the airstrip. The weather was out. We continued waiting and checking the weather forecast. We considered many alternative climbs, but they were also requiring good weather. With a bad weather forecast for as far as the scientist could see, we considered how much money we were spending just sitting in Haines. We also didn't have unlimited time for the expedition. In the end, money and time won. We flew home without even seeing the mountain. For me, it was getting worse. Was my great string of northern summits going to end like this? I was now 64 years old. There was no surety. 2008. The next year, Dave Koval, Edward Earle, and Greg Sladen went back to Fairweather. This time I wasn't even on the trip. They flew in and moved their camp into the upper basin at 12,300 feet. This would shorten their summit climb, but the upper basin is an avalanche-prone place. They started for the summit, but the mountain played yet another card. With warmer years, the crevasses in the steep slope to the saddle had opened up. Dave, Edward, and Greg moved up as high as they could muster, but the crevasses stopped them. They descended and flew out. Good grief, another defeat. 2010. Try again, right? 2 years later, a strong group of friends convened for what looked like my summit team. I was joined by Bill Blazek, Kurt Wiebemeyer, Wayne Herrick, Rich McAdams, Dave Koval, Jim Ricard, and Mike Butane. Mount Fairweather had probably never seen such a star-studded team. What could possibly go wrong? This time we used two pilots to expedite our large team. In addition to Drake, we used Paul Swanstrom of Mountain Flying Service. With decent weather, we all flew in and convened on the Grand Plateau. We ferried loads and set an advance base camp at 11,000 feet at the entrance to the upper basin. Then there was a discussion about putting a higher camp in the upper basin at 12,300 feet. I was against this plan since I had seen the avalanche hazard there. You are exposed to steep slopes on three sides. However, democracy won and we moved camp up into the basin. Ready for our summit climb, the atmosphere had other ideas. The weather went out. It went out hard, and we spent a nervous night in our exposed camp while it snowed several feet. In the wee hours, I left my tent to shovel and look around. I could just see the slopes above me. They all looked pregnant with an overload of snow and ready to deliver. In an unearthly silence, I wondered if my northern odyssey would end here in suffocation. I had been outvoted, but now, never mind the summit, I resolved to leave this camp and never camp here again. When the others woke, looked around, listened to my speech about moving camp back down to a safer spot, we did just that. Now we could think about the summit again. Like a normal storm, it passed on. When a clear morning arrived, we launched for the summit. I was roped with Wayne, one of the fittest climbers I had ever known, and I looked forward to summiting with Wayne. However, I was too slow for mighty Wayne. When we reached our cache in the upper basin, I unroped for a break. Wayne took off like a rocket up the hill. At the time, I assumed that we would rejoin our joint summit quest higher up. Wrong again. Wayne was sprinting for the summit with whoever he could get to go with him. He grabbed Kurt, and the two of them sprinted ahead. Mike was back in camp with a knee problem. Bill turned around at the base of the headwall. Jim proclaimed that he was done in both mentally and physically, which was a big surprise coming from the man who had stomped St. Elias with aplomb. Jim unroped, turned around, and started down by himself. I continued with Dave and Rich McAdams. Higher, on the ridge, Wayne and Kurt were out of sight. They would make it. As Dave, Rich, and I started up the steeper slopes, my climb ran aground again. Rich and I were not moving well at this point either. We plotted up for a while longer, but the snitch had us. I stopped. Tears filled my eyes as I looked at the magnificent scenery, and I finally thought that, yes, this was it. I simply couldn't climb these peaks anymore. If I turned now, I would live with more memories than I deserved. Denali 3 times, Lucania, Steele, Logan, Foraker, Hunter, Rainier, Blackburn, Sanford, Pona, East Kahiltna, King, and St. Elias. This was my northern crown. Asking for fair weather was too much. It was a young person's game now. I had grown too old. I now had to own the crown that I had already earned. Wiping my freezing tears, we turned and descended. 2011. Jennifer and I were getting along great. We were climbing up a storm in the western states and had managed several far-flung international trips to other peaks that I had lusted after for a lifetime. This seemed like a good way to proceed. Then the phone rang. It was my good friend Chris Kopczynski. Chris made the first American ascent of the Eiger North Face with John Roskelly in 1974. Chris climbed Everest back in 1981. I had finished my 8-continent summits odyssey on top of Karstens Pyramid in New Guinea with Chris in 1994. Chris was near my age and was also consumed by his inability to climb Mount Fairweather. Chris was on a program to not just climb Fairweather as a swan song, but make a film about it. A big part of the film was to make an environmental statement and give a tribute to his dad. Chris grew up in Spokane, Washington, and in addition to climbing, was an avid fisherman. He believed that the last and best fishery on the planet were the waters west of Fairweather. Instead of just bemoaning our losses, he wanted to celebrate what we have left. Chris wanted to summit Fairweather and place his dad's favorite fishing lure, a Lucky Louie, on the summit, overlooking the last best fishery. It was a grand project. I had never had to try for a peak 4 times. This would break my old record of 3 attempts max, but I signed on. In my gut, I knew that Chris was the right person to be with. Now, all we had to do was climb Fairweather. Chris signed on Bryson Williams from Spokane, a strong young climber who would add a youthful spark to our project. I added the famous Norwegian climber Petter Bjørstad, who I knew by his reputation, which was considerable. Like Chris and I, Petter had climbed all over the world. I decided to drive north via Spokane, then take the ferry to Haines. This would be a pilgrimage. I spent several days in Spokane with Chris and others, getting every last detail in place. Chris showed me a movie he had taken from a flight around Fairweather years earlier. The upper ridge looked unreal. At the end of the film, Chris said, "Kind of makes your hands sweat, doesn't it?" I met Bryson, and we all sat with the filmmaker to pour out one-liners about it all. The name that Chris had already chosen for the film was Wisdom Earned. The subtitle was A Mountain Climber's Perspective. By the time this exploit was over, we would certainly learn and earn plenty of wisdom and gain new perspective. Perhaps they should have interviewed us after the climb. When all the parties and hoopla were finished, I drove on to Bellingham and caught a view of Mount Baker, a peak that had taken me 3 tries to summit back in 1970. Win or lose, on Fairweather, I was now breaking that record number of tries. I caught the Alaska State Ferry northbound. First on the ferry, I was able to pitch my tough mountain tent in the center of the open rear deck. My home for the ferry ride was well secured against any rogue winds. I met Petter in Haines, and we became instant friends, and we shared the final ferry ride to Haines together. Through my connection with Marlene Swift in Colorado, I had met her dad, Paul, and his wife, Annie, who still lived in Haines, where Marlene had grown up. Paul and Annie now hosted Petter and I in their tidy loft room in their Haines home. Paul was intensely interested in our climb, and we yakked for hours about dozens of climbs. Staying with Paul and Annie was a big boon to our start. Petter and I huddled in our tiny loft and compared notes on our Alaskan climbs. Petter had climbed Blackburn in 2009 via its northwest ridge that we had descended in 1977. I was interested in how he approached the ridge, so he showed me on the map. He had landed in a high basin northwest of Blackburn at 9,600 feet, and Dub climbed a lower western spur of the northwest ridge that we had not used in 1977. I told Petter that he must have made the first ascent of that spur, and so on. There was a lot to talk about. We would fly to the mountain with Paul Swanstrom, but we needed good weather to do that. On May 11, we took off in good weather. Oh boy, this was it. Flying, we had sensational views. When we reached the point on the flight in when we should have seen fair weather, all we saw was foul weather. Paul stared at the clouds for a long minute, then turned his plane around. There was no way he could fly into those solid clouds and land. Poof, we were back in Haines. To entertain ourselves the next day, we hiked up the famous little peak Rapinski above Haines. Having been there dozens of times, Paul Swift told us exactly how to do it. The next day, May 13, we took off for the mountain again. Oh boy, this was it! Flying, we had sensational views. My heart was singing as we flew along through peaks that could stir any soul. Thankfully, I didn't have to climb them all, just fair weather. Where was that pesky peak, anyway? As we approached the area, we caught a glimpse of foul weather just before it sank into its own clouds. The atmosphere was in charge, not us. Poof, we were back in Haines. Petter and I retreated to our loft and began looking at the calendar. Petter had allowed several weeks for this trip, but he did have a schedule. We had already lost a week. With a whatever-it-takes attitude, Chris and I had planned an open-ended schedule. The next day, May 14th, we took off again for our third try at flying in. Oh boy, this was it! Flying, we had sensational views. This time, Paul Swanstrom landed us on the plateau. Now, all we had to do was climb Mount Fairweather. The next day, we pulled sleds loaded with gear and made one trip up to our advanced base camp at 11,000 feet. Chris and I agreed that we would not camp higher in the avalanche-prone basin. Make or break, we would attempt the summit from this camp. Over the next several days, in marginal weather, we went up into the basin and fixed ropes up the headwall. The crevasses were bad this year, and we chose a line well to the right of previous year's routes. There were many big crevasses, and some of them yawned open wide enough to be on the fringe of stopping us. At the highest chasm, Chris led with a great King Kong move. He just barely got across. With 800 feet of fixed rope in place, we descended, left a cache of technical gear at the bottom of the lowest rope, and retreated to camp to prepare for the summit. By now, you know the story. The weather went completely out. We had no choice but to wait. Hours turned into days. Petter and I shared one tent, and Chris and Bryson shared the other tent. We would shovel, talk, shovel, eat, shovel, sleep, repeat. On day three, we added ice climbing on a nearby sérac to our list of diversions. Finally, we knew that we had to launch a summit climb. Early the next morning, we were walking uphill into the basin. I was done with the oh boy routine. This was serious business. The weather had milling clouds but looked promising. When we reached the base of the ropes, there was no sign of our cache. Many feet of new snow had fallen, and significant sloughs had come down the face above and buried the entire area. We had to have the equipment, so we started digging. We dug, 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 and dug. We could not find the cache. While digging, I kept looking at the weather. By the end of our failed digging session, the weather was completely gone again. There was no chance that we could climb Fairweather in weather this foul. We descended in a whiteout and returned to camp. Our summit climb had not even taken us to the top of our ropes. At least our camp at 11,000 feet was safe from avalanches. Big slides would rumble down Fairweather's north face, but they dumped onto the glacier far from camp. We had gotten this camp's placement right. Back to waiting. Days were turning into weeks. For Petter, this meant worrying about his many commitments back in Norway. He was running out of time. But he was also stuck on a glacier. Petter has a PhD in computer science from Stanford, and we talked about 100 subjects, solved problems, and discussed big life subjects. Every day of foul weather pushed Petter closer to missing his deadlines. Chris and I remained resolute. This climb was somehow different. It was not just about the summit. In spite of the continuing, massive consternation about this climb, film, and entire Fairweather project, I enjoyed being there. It is one of the better glaciated zones we have left in North America. It was still the Great Land, and I still loved it. During the waiting, I took excursions outside and found special scenes that few human eyes ever see firsthand. We had been keeping track of the wind direction and the weather forecast. For the last 2 weeks, the wind had been steady out of the west or southwest. It was these onshore winds that brought the steady moisture. The forecast had all been dismal as well. What we needed was a north wind to blow the crud away. Finally, on a dismal day, we had a better forecast. The next day, the clouds still milled, but there was no wind. We did some extra digging around camp, just in case. Suddenly, we heard a plane. The weather was good enough away from the peak that one of the pilots was willing and able to fly here. That was a sure sign of improvement. Then we heard the plane landing down on the plateau. People were coming in. I knew that Dave Koval, with a team of four, was scheduled to arrive about this time. Their arrival would inject fresh enthusiasm into our dreary game. In the next moments, I saw Petter madly packing his gear. He was now overdue for his home commitments and had made the agonizing decision to run down to the plane and fly out. Obviously, he had been pondering this choice for weeks. Life does have a way of interfering with summits, especially this one. After a hurried goodbye, Petter took off down the hill. Bryson went with him to break a new trail and help Petter carry his gear. When Chris and I started organizing the now messy camp for a new summit operation, we heard a second plane. Yes, people were coming in. Soon, Bryson came sprinting back up the hill and started madly packing his gear. He had seen the plane and sniffed his ticket out of this dreary mess. After another hurried goodbye, Bryson rocketed down the trail. Petter radioed that he was at the plane and was flying out. Now, just the two of us, Chris and I took a somber look at each other. Poof, half our team was gone. We knew that Bryson wasn't the happiest camper up here, but didn't realize he was so homesick that he would bolt. Nevertheless, Chris and I were still adamant about this climb, and would climb the peak with just the two of us if that's what was required. After a few more hours, Dave and his teammates arrived, and we had fresh hellos. Dave's was with John Martristek, his wife Debbie Markham, and Greg Long. This strong team indeed brought fresh energy and news, and suddenly everything was abuzz. Our needed north wind had arrived, so we discussed how and when we would go for the summit. The next day, I told Dave that Chris and I would launch our summit climb from this camp. After their own team discussion, Dave decided to pack up into the upper basin, and they started up that afternoon. We made a plan that Chris and I would start extremely early the next morning and catch them. Hopefully, we could all climb to the summit together. On May 25th, Chris and I had no trouble starting up the hill in the wee hours. Better, we used the trail stomped by Dave's team the afternoon before. When we arrived at their camp, John was just starting up the hill toward our ropes, so we were in the groove. Our cache below the ropes was now long gone, but Dave's team had the gear we needed. The ropes were also buried, so Chris moved to the front with John, and they were able to pull them out of the snow. It was slow, but up we went. The weather was clear. Oh boy, this was it. In the sunny days, many days since we had first been here to place the ropes, the crevasses had widened considerably. With the ropes anchored above, we could still muscle across the gaps, but Chris and I realized that these gaps would now be showstoppers if we had to lead the route for the first time. We had placed our vital fixed ropes just in time. When we reached the ridge, we reset for the summit climb up the west ridge. Dave, fresh and hungry for the summit, walked through from the rear to the lead. He was roped to Greg. John and Debbie were roped, and John led the second rope. I tied in with Chris. We put GoPro video cameras on our heads, and I led our third rope. We walked across the lower angle portion of the ridge, past the point where I had turned 6 years earlier, and started up the steeper slopes. The weather was clear, we were tenacious, and we were headed up. From below, the upper west ridge looks like it has many crevasse problems, but we solved them one by one. There were no showstoppers. The climb was easier than I expected. I just kept looking back at Chris, and when I could catch his eye, I just pointed up. We didn't need verbal communication. This is what we had waited and worked for. Step by deliberate step, the summit inched closer. The upper slopes were sublime. The surrounding peaks fell away, and the expanse of ocean to our right grew. Like all high peaks, the approaching summit was in a different universe from the world below. Getting tired now was not an option. In fact, for me, it was the opposite. With each step, I felt more energy. I kept the rope to Chris tight, hoping that I could transmit my summit fever to him. Like so many others, the final smooth slope was a rite of passage. Approaching the summit, I chose a slightly steeper, more exposed line on the right side of the rounded ridge. This gave Chris and I a more expansive view of the ocean. I knew that Chris was carrying his dad's Lucky Louie fishing lure, and that the ocean fishery, now consuming much of our horizon, was a big part of the film Wisdom Earned. The final slope was also a no-fall zone, so I made sure that every step was steady and secure. When the slope angle relented, I saw my mates waiting on the highest point for the arrival of these two mountaineers with gray beards, who had strived so hard to be up here. When I reached the tippy top, I turned and pulled in the rope as Chris approached. When he arrived, he grabbed me in an awkward bear hug that just about knocked me over. After our bear hug, Chris fell to his knees and launched into his emotional speech. We all exclaimed that he had to wait a minute moment so we could get the cameras rolling. Chris, still on his knees, restarted, and we captured his speech. It was a good one. He talked passionately about the last great natural ecosystem of the world now spread before us, then put his dad's Lucky Louie lure on a wand, kissed it, and jammed it onto Fairweather's highest point. In a touch that was prophetic, considering the loss of salmon that humanity has produced, the wand broke. Chris, a construction engineer, was nonplussed. He grabbed the now shorter wand and jammed it in with even more zest. The weather remained clear, so we had time for the usual photos. Now it was time for smiles. Our careful descent to the top of the headwall went well. Once I poked my foot into a hole, but immediately yanked it out. I would have none of that crevasse nonsense now. Descending the headwall, we cleared our 800 feet of rope and brought it down with us. At the camp in the upper basin, Chris and I loaded ourselves with as much as we could carry and moved slowly down to our lower camp. Dave's group would spend one more night in their upper camp and rejoin us the next day. It was almost over. The next morning, Chris and I went to work extracting our tents from the deep pits they were in after weeks in the same spot. After several hours, there was still no sign of the others coming down, and we began to wonder why. Finally, they arrived, and yes, there was a story. Fairweather still had something to say. During their last night in their avalanche-prone camp, an avalanche swept down the face of Fairweather overlooking the upper basin. It swept into the basin, crossed some of the route into the basin, but did not reach the camp. Prophetically, the near-barrier crevasse that guarded the entrance to the upper basin gobbled up much of the debris. Dave's group had to pick their way across the awkward avalanche debris to get out of the basin. The twists in one's giant vortex of life often hinge on a few feet. However, safely back in our 11,000-foot camp, we had energy to celebrate. The rest of the world, with its films, promises, and problems, would return soon enough. The next day, we moved our mountain of gear down to the landing zone, where I spent hours digging out the cache that I had left there weeks earlier. The weather was still good, and I was eager to fly out before it changed its mind. There were stories of parties spending weeks stuck in this landing camp, mired in bad weather. Late in the afternoon, Paul Swanstrom landed to fly me out. We quickly loaded his plane, I climbed in, and we roared down the glacier. It's always quite a jump from laboring a foot at a time on a high peak to going 120 miles an hour. I watched the glacier recede below me, took a last peek back at Fairweather, then settled in to enjoy the flight past the myriad peaks, glaciers, and fjords that lie between Fairweather and Haines. As we flew along at 10,000 feet, I calculated that this was my 10th time doing this magnificent flight. That was another record. However, I couldn't help noticing what looked like pollution on the horizon. What? Pollution? Not here in the sacred Glacier Bay National Park. I looked left. There it was. I looked right. There it was. I craned and looked back. There it was. I looked forward. There it was. I stared around in disbelief for several minutes. There must be a better explanation for what I was seeing, so I pulled forward and asked Paul over the engine's rumble, "Paul, what's wrong with the air?" Paul turned and replied calmly, "That's Chinese pollution. When the wind shifted to the north and allowed you to summit, it brought the pollution with it. We see it all the time now." I sagged back in disbelief. But I knew a brown pollution cloud when I saw one. I scanned around again. The pollution circled the horizon in a complete 360. I muttered to myself, "What's wrong with this picture?" I settled back, trying to spot the pristine peaks that I knew were there. I couldn't see them. Paul was taking a little different route than I had been on before, and I looked down to see a horrible muddy mess. I studied the jumbled muddle, but it was extensive, and I didn't know where it came from or what it was. So I leaned forward again and asked, "Paul, what's that mud mess below?" Paul again answered calmly, "That's the snout of the Muir Glacier." Then he snatched a postcard from a pocket, handed it back to me, and said, "It used to look like this." I grabbed the postcard and looked at the photo of a beautiful tidewater glacier pushing miles out into the ocean, a glacier worthy of being named after the famous John Muir. Then I looked down at the muddy reality. The glacier had receded many miles, and the ice was now so far up the valley that I couldn't see it. If there was any ice up there, it was covered with gook. I looked at the postcard. I looked at the ugly reality. I looked at the amazing photo in the postcard. I looked at the muddy waters where ice used to live. I looked at the pollution circling the horizon. Then I shut my eyes and remembered all the high North American peaks I had climbed in the last 52 years. Iztaccíhuatl, Popocatépetl, Orizaba, Denali, Rainier, Wrangell, Steele, Lucania, Logan, Foraker, Blackburn, Denali again and again, Hunter, Sanford, King, St. Elias, East Kehiltna, Bona, and finally Fairweather. I was almost 68 years old. I was done. In those moments in the plane, I retired from my northern heights. My long northern mountain symphony was complete, and it had morphed into a grand opera. I was grateful that it was not a tragedy. I was fortunate to have climbed through a half century when these peaks had plenty of snow, magic, and mystery. Oh, and the snow came from plenty of storms. Looking back, I realized that I was on the summit of every peak in my list, with no one else there except my teammates. The same was true for my 8 continent summits odyssey. Times have changed. I still love the great land and have returned for lower peaks, but nothing over 15,000 feet. My map is green. Time to leave it alone. Thanks for listening to my great Northern Heights saga.